You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Last time we were looking at the impact that Airbnb has had on the cities where it's been implemented. Airbnb's impact in Barcelona, for example, has been multifaceted, but at least part of it is destructive. It erodes the quality of life for those living in high-intensity tourist neighborhoods. It prevents the city from being able to balance tourism with other aspects of city life, and it impedes attempts by the city to establish safety and other standards. Paris shows the same pattern as Amsterdam and Barcelona. The city is Airbnb's biggest market, with over 50,000 listings, so many that in summer 2014, the popular Marais district saw more than 66,000 Airbnb visitors, which is slightly more than the 64,000 people who actually live there. The impact on the city obviously has been significant. Here is Ian Brossat, the city's director of housing. Quote, "There is already a serious shortage of flats in Paris, especially studios and two-room apartments where couples might start a life together. Now, we have this growing problem of holiday lets, with investors moving in and buying up as much as they can. It has become a business, and the result is fewer properties on the market for ordinary Parisians and higher prices for what is actually available. In Paris, you can rent out your primary residence for short periods to holidaymakers. But the Paris government believes that as many as two-thirds of properties being rented on very short lets are not primary residences." As usual, Airbnb had platitudes but no data to counter this claim. In February 2015, Airbnb made an agreement with the mayor of Paris to enforce the law. But by May 2015, relationships seemed to have taken a turn for the worse again, as the city ran spot checks on 2,000 listings in the Marais area. Lead officer François Plotin said, quote, "The city of our city is becoming deserted. More and more, there's no residents, just tourists. The company's claim to let you, quote, live like a local loses its meaning when there are no more locals left. Its claim to promote a shared city sounds increasingly like a cover for an American company that's not interested in understanding that other countries and cities are different and have the right to make their own rules for their own reasons." If there is any city where Airbnb should be at home, it should be Portland, Oregon. In March 2014, this was where Airbnb announced it had, quote, shared cities initiatives. Portland was the first city to partner with Airbnb on a number of initiatives, designs to help the company fit into the urban fabric. And the company also announced that it was building its first office outside of San Francisco. Airbnb got legal approval from Portland to legitimize its business hosts. And they would get safety inspections. They would notify the neighbors. And they would also get a $180 permit. Airbnb would pay lodging taxes on behalf of the hosts. Quote, "We have to strike a balance between how we accommodate commerce, including this new kind, and our great neighborhoods," said Mayor Charlie Haley's, adding, quote, "I think we've got it right this time." But again, the relationship deteriorated quickly. As the deadline for getting a permit approached, only 166 hosts of about 1,600 had got one. The city demanded the addresses and city permits of the hosts from Airbnb. Airbnb Director for Public Policy David Owen refused, saying the data was private. City Commissioner Nick Fish challenged Owen, saying that Airbnb was claiming, quote, "an exemption from all other laws and rules of society because we're somehow on the internet. We welcomed you to Portland. We're pleased that you harness the internet. But, sir, we have to make sure that the guests in one of your host's places, and you do not inspect your host places, we have to make sure that that guest is safe." At the time of this writing, the deadline has passed, but no actions have been taken in Portland against hosts or against Airbnb. The repetitive trajectory of Airbnb's growth in tourist centers is particularly sad because there is a clear potential for new forms of informal and low-intensity short-term and tourist accommodations, like older-style hostel offerings and digital initiatives such as couch surfing. But Airbnb's investors have put a lot of money into the company, and they expect a return, so Airbnb needs to grow. To satisfy its investors, Airbnb has no choice but to seek to become a global company, operating at scale in many cities as it can find. And with that goal, any of the benefits of informal sharing are being pushed to one side. The company still speaks of sharing, still uses those heartwarming stories, but as it professionalizes its hosts and seeks to deliver a consistent brand experience, it's playing an increasingly destructive role in global travel, preventing cities from striking the balance they need to find between tourism and the other needs of a healthy city. There are many actions it could take to stay closer to the city-friendly image it projects. It could limit the number of properties a host lists on the site, limit the number of days a host can rent a property, or limit the density of listings in a neighborhood, for example. But it chooses not to do so. To finish this chapter, there's another story, this one of Airbnb in Rome. I live in Canada, but my family of origin lies in the UK. And while I was visiting them last year, my sister and I got to take a trip to Rome for a few days. It was a great trip. We stayed in a rented apartment, in case you were wondering, but not rented through Airbnb. And one of our favorite parts of it was spending an afternoon in the Trastevere district. Why, Trastevere doesn't have big sights. It does have many cobbled streets, charming restaurants, a beautiful square, and one of the oldest cathedrals in the city. It's a more artisan, bohemian atmosphere than some other areas of the city, and that's part of its appeal. Like so many other visitors, we love Trastevere. And like other tourists, we brought money with us and spent some of it there. So in a way out visit was good for the city too. But of course, our presence is a mixed blessing. Too much tourism can erode the very things that make Trevisteri so atmospheric and special, especially when things are the authentic life of the locals, raising the cost of living and putting pressure on property prices. In the end, as tourists, you have to hope that the city of Rome and the neighborhood itself finds ways to balance the various pressures acting on the place where they live. Not surprisingly, Trevisteri does have conflicts over gentrification and the impact of tourism. Here's a story from last September. In 1956, a cinema opened in Trevisteri called Cinema America, and it was a feature of the area until it closed sometime around the year 2000. In 2004, it was bought by a new set of owners and who decided to tear it down or place it with a parking lot and some apartments. There was local opposition to the plan and stalemate until November 2012, when a group of young people occupied the cinema. By all accounts, they turned it into a focal point for the community and also attracted some big names in Italian cinema and the arts. In September 2014, the occupiers were evicted by the police, but they have apparently set up elsewhere in the neighborhood, and the campaign continues. What does all this have to do with Airbnb? Well, in the book, there's a figure that shows a map of 8,000 Airbnb rentals in Rome as of May 2014. It shows that the rentals are densest and the most expensive in the middle of the city, and that's also where the most expensive listings are. Using the number of reviews as a proxy for the relative number of visits allows an estimate of which listings are the most valuable to Airbnb. Here, by this estimate, is the most valuable listing in Rome, the one with perhaps the highest rental income of any city. It is the dot that is shown in Figure 2. The Figure 2 shows that just south of this listing, you can see the Basilica di Santa Maria in Trevisteri. This listing is, you will not be surprised to know, right in Trevisteri. It's a beautiful looking place, although not exactly cheap, at over $600 per night. The listing text says that it has been selected by the Airbnb staff who stayed and filmed there for an upcoming Airbnb hosting in Rome video, so its charms have been noticed by the company as well. Airbnb, of course, says that its hosts are, quote, regular people who occasionally rent out their homes and use the income to pay their bills. So who is the host for this particularly successful rental? Well, turns out that Martin is not so much a regular Trevisteri resident. He does have family roots in Rome, but is a Harvard-educated technology entrepreneur who lives in Austin, Texas, and who is renting out the places I bought with the proceeds from my last software company. He is now CEO of VreeEasy, a novel software platform which is growing force in the tourism and travel market. Martin is listed as an Airbnb superhost. In addition to the historic Nobleman's Loft, his listing page shows in April 2015 a total of 6 listings on the site, one more in Rome, an ultimate panoramic Roman penthouse, one near Monaco, 2 in Barcelona, and 1 seaplane cabin that he will fly to any legal European lake so that you can use it as a hotel. Now, I don't know Martin, and I've made no effort to talk to him, because this is not really about Martin. This is about Airbnb. And the gap between the idealized regular people they present and the reality of multiple property owners is large. It's the gap between their message of caring for neighborhoods and the reality of gentrification driven by uncontrolled tourism, which they are playing a big part in accelerating. Airbnb's true business and travesty is eroding the very qualities that make the district appealing. And it's exactly the kind of business that the locals in Travesti are protesting. Now, my comment on this is that recently it's been pointed out that there's very, very few residents left in a city like Venice. Most have moved to the mainland from the city of Venice and have Airbnb'd their apartments. So virtually the entire city is now tourists using Airbnb or other similar platforms to rent apartments for the short term. And so there are very few people actually living in Venice as Venetians. And so I would like to point that out. I can't comment as whether that is a good development or a bad one, but it is certainly having an effect on who you meet when you go to Venice.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy by Tom Slee. Chapter 4, On the Move with Uber. There's one sector of the sharing economy that's bigger than accommodation, and that's transit, and specifically ride sharing. Just as Airbnb dominates the accommodation market, so Uber dominates ride sharing. But Uber did not create its market the way Airbnb did. The story of ride sharing is a set of companies learning from and competing with each other until one emerged victorious. Before ride sharing came car sharing. Car sharing is people getting time-limited access to a car, while ride sharing is a person being a passenger in a car driven by someone else. Just as a sharing economy is no longer a realistic description, so ride sharing is not accurate, to the point that the Associated Press style book explicitly says not to use it to describe Uber. Some have taken to calling this model ride sourcing. The AP style book suggests ride hailing or ride booking services. Nevertheless, the phrase ride sharing, inaccurate as it may be, is still more widely used, and I will use it without the scare quotes. But let's start with car sharing. Zip car. Car sharing cooperatives have been around for a long time, some run as nonprofits and some as commercial companies. There is a continuous history of activity starting in the 1970s, and in the Kitchener-Waterloo, where I live, Community Car Share was founded in 1998 and is still running. But in 2000, the Danielson and Robert Chase started Zipcar. They bought a new ambition to the space, just as the story of Airbnb is featured in Rachel Botsman and Rue Rogers, What's Mine is Yours, Zipcar, takes the pole position in Lisa Gansky's 2010 book, The Mesh, Why the Future of Business is Sharing. Zipcar was never a peer-to-peer company, as the cars were all owned by the company, but it was a form of shared or collaborative consumption based on digital technology. Gansky quotes Chase as saying, "Once Danielson described a Berlin car-sharing service to her, a light bulb went off in my head. I thought, this was what the internet was made for. Perhaps even more than Airbnb, Zipcar became the original sharing economy company." And Zipcar did grow. From its beginnings in Boston in 2001 and New York 2003, then San Francisco in 2005, then Toronto 2006, London later the same year, reaching about a quarter of a million members by 2008. Zipcar continued to expand. It provided an iPhone app to help you book a car. It took investments from Benchmark Capital and General Electric's Commercial Finance Fleet Services. It merged with competitor Flexcar. It created a partnership with Spanish car rental company Avoncar. It acquired a UK service Streetcar. The appeal of the company was economic, social, and environmental. It provided affordable driving options, access over ownership. It fostered an alternate community feel. You are a member rather than a customer. And it promoted a green image, a more efficient use of resources than individual ownership. It's a combination that continues to draw people to the sharing economy. Sadly, the appeal to community turned out to be more hope than reality. In 2012, researchers Floria Bardhi and Gianna Eckhart interviewed a set of Zipcar users in Boston, rode with them, and found that Zipcar users were motivated by self-interest and utilitarianism rather than by any altruistic community motives. The researchers expected a community to emerge around the Zipcar brand, but found that users resisted the company's efforts to create a community beyond the straightforward fact of market exchange. Zipcar users were prepared to look out for their own interest at the expense of the object, namely the car, as well as other users, so that surveillance and command controls are welcome to stop other users from treating the shared cars badly. In an interview, the authors say Zipcar uses a strict style of governance to maintain compliance with the rules of car sharing to make sure cars aren't brought back late. The gas tank is filled, etc. Customers like and even want more of this surveillance, as they feel it is the only way the system can work effectively, since they don't trust each other to obey the rules without Zipcar's heavy-handed enforcement. Bardhi and Eckhart also expected Zipcar users to be motivated by political consumerism, especially as it relates to anti-car environmental concerns, but they found no evidence of these motivations either. The Zipcar experience was clearly a lot more normal mainstream consumer exchanges than advocates were claiming. So perhaps it should have been no surprise when, in January 2013, Zipcar was bought by rental company Avis. With that purchase, there was no longer a suggestion that the relationship between Zipcar users and the company is anything other than a straightforward commercial exchange with the usual company brand promotion, and that there was no suggestion of any relationship at all between Zipcar users and each other. The brand continues to promote its environmental message, saying no one of its university pages that every day we are working towards a place with less dependence on personally owned vehicles. Why? because it matters. Each and every Zipcar takes 15 personally owned vehicles off the road. But there is little substance behind this particular claim. Sociologist John Sadowski traced it to a report from the Transportation Research Board dated 2005, which matched the early days of Zipcar, which covered all kinds of car sharing, profit and non-profit. And the main cause of the result is families forgiving the purchase of a car and choosing a car share instead. The Transportation Research Board did not make a big deal of this as environmental benefit. There is nothing to suggest that the total number of car miles driven decreases after all, just that car ownership decreases. Zipcar's claim of environmental benefit depends on the baseline comparison. It is plausible that a Zipcar has less environmental impact than 15 personal cars. It is equally plausible that a Zipcar has more environmental image than the widespread use of public transit. So it is cheeky to say at least that Zipcar is using a 15-car figure as part of an effort to encourage university students to take up car sharing, efforts that are likely to add to the number of cars on the road rather than reduce it. Zipcar's university's page promises a different degree of freedom, the convenience of car ownership without the hassles of having a car on campus. The freedom and convenience are in comparison to the use of public transit. So, community has gone, and environmental benefit is promoted only when it is convenient for the company. What's left is a company that, as Juliet Skohor writes, was, quote, once the shining face of the sharing economy and is now a sub-brand of Avis, unquote. Meanwhile, less ambitious car-sharing initiatives, such as my local car-sharing co-op, continue to operate much as they did a decade ago. The Zipcar story is similar to that of Airbnb, an original motivation based around community and around an interaction that is not primarily economic. The hunger for growth, the rapid expansion, the erosion of the original model, the end game of a large company, successful in economic terms, that has completely failed to challenge current economic models and that fails to deliver on the sustainability or community ideals. Despite the anti-consumerist talk of the advocates, these scaled-up sharing economy companies are just as consumerist as those that they have recently disrupted. We'll be looking at other examples of the sharing economy which are not quite as good as they are advertised in subsequent shows. Please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Beach.